Hello, and welcome back to the H-Span Podcast, your go-to podcast for longevity policy discussion. I'm your host, Dylan Livingston. Today, I am sitting down with Andrew Brack, Program Manager at ARPA-H. In this episode, we discussed Andrew's unique journey that led him to the longevity world, what Prosper is doing to move the longevity and health span industry forward, and what his hopes are for ARPA-H being a catalyst for longevity and health span innovation. Without further ado, here's Andrew Brack.
Live long and prosper.
Andrew Brack, thank you so much for joining the H-Span podcast. We're honored to have you, and I'm really excited to hear about Prosper and the work you're doing at ARPA-H. So thanks for coming, and say hi to our audience for us.
It's great to be here, Dylan. Thanks for the opportunity to talk, and it's great to see everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Andrew, the first thing I like to ask my guests is about their background. You got your PhD in molecular biology from King's College in London, first actually at King's College, and then you went to Stanford, and then you went to UCSF. So can you talk about some of your previous work and give our audience a little bit of background as to who you are and what your area of expertise is all about?
Sure. Way back in the day, my career path's been nonlinear. And so I do think some of those things are important to touch on and why I'm here today. So I did my undergrad in exercise physiology. And so I've always been interested in muscle biology, adaptation to exercise, and things like that. I then transitioned to a PhD in molecular biology biophysics at King's College. Really, that was about building microscopes and understanding the orientation of proteins. So very biophysics-y. Got the PhD. And loved science. And I thought, I've got a career in science here I'd like to pursue, but the physics part of biophysics was just too hard. And so I'm like, let's focus on the bio if I want any chance of career of this.
I was a physics major, by the way, so I'm with you on that. It's hard.
It was hard. But I enjoyed it, but I was like, there's going to be a lot more people who are better at this than me. And then I started getting into this biology of aging issue. And at that time, we'd understand there was stem cells and that they were functional in various animals, all animals, and that they lost their function during aging. So that sort of took me to Stanford, where I did my postdoc with Tom Rando. And at the time, this was at that earlier or this year before that big, the seminal paper from Tom's lab with Arena and Mike Conboy, where they identified soluble factors and really turned on its head this idea that aging was this one-way street. And actually, the phenotype of aging and functional decline could be reversed. And those aged mice, when they're exposed to the youthful serum, became young again, phenotypically and functionally. So I joined the lab, and my project, we were baymates with Arena and Mike Conboy. And the idea of my project was to look at the pro-aging factors through the lens of fibrosis during tissue repair. As tissue repair doesn't happen rapidly or as effectively when we're old, what happens is an accumulation of fat and connective tissue. So that was my project and how the soluble factors regulate that. And then that took me to start in my own lab, first at Mass General Hospital, and then on to UCSF. And so at Mass General, we were at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, really in those early days of trying to figure out hematopoietic stem cells, muscle stem cells, and how they were regulated. And I carried on that work at UCSF, really looking at a couple of different things that was going on during my sort of career at that point. I was really doubling down in this idea of understanding stem cell fate decisions. So how can you have this sort of stem cell and what will it choose to do based on its intrinsic program or its environment? We knew during aging in the muscle, these stem cells would lose their fate potential, lose their proliferative capacity. So we try and understand the circuits or the logic circuits a cell would make those choices. One of the pieces of work I was really excited by was we started targeting radiation as a stress. And most people who listen to this podcast will understand that sort of link with radiation and aging and spaceflight even maybe. And so we identified this radiation-resistant muscle stem cell. And we were using genetic markers that would allow us to indelibly mark it. So it was a rarefied stem cell that didn't contribute much in normal repair, but it became the dominant stem cell in the context of repair under radiation stress because it was resistant. And at that time then, this is 2012, sorry, we were thinking about how we can model those stem cell trajectories using AI and machine learning and single cell transcriptomics. And that led me to have this sort of intersection of machine learning, computation, and biology and stem cell decisions.
Beautiful. It's worth noting, Andrew, by the way, our previous guest was, or guests were, Mike and Irina Convoy.
Awesome. I hope they said nice things.
The circle is now complete. It's a progression of the old days. I love to hear it. So,
well, you know, it's interesting, right? So I remember I was talking to Irina maybe a year or so back, thinking about the development of the industry. And when we were postdocs, we were publishing work in highly cited journals, etc. Never thought there was just going to be a single company that would be tackling longevity in some way or another. So it's fantastic the development that's come through those last 15 years, but more is certainly needed.
Agreed 100%. And I think the work that we're both doing will lead to the growth of this industry. But the longevity field, and I think a lot of people don't appreciate this, is it's so new, right? Even 5-10 years ago, 2015, 2020, there were maybe a dozen companies that were doing this, and now there are hundreds. So it's really exciting space. I always equate this to where like AI was maybe like 20 years ago or 15, 20 years ago. It's starting to pick up, and we should see the fruits of the industry's work sometime in the future, and hopefully the near future.
That's right.
Absolutely. So what sparked your passion for longevity and health span research? How has that evolved? You touched on it a little bit, but what kind of sparked this passion for you? Was it something that happened in your personal life? Was it just an interest of science? What was it for you?
Yeah, I hear people with these really passionate stories about their loved ones getting sick. I don't have that. Mine was, this is a really curious scientific challenge. But it also came from that exercise physiology background where you can do these training protocols, you can get bigger and stronger when you're younger. And it doesn't happen when you age. So that to me was biologically a curious question. And, you know, I was exploring biology as a career and I was thinking, we know quite a bit about cancer. We know things about, we really don't know anything about aging. And so for me, it was that sort of, here's a tough nut to crack. Let's go down that path. So to answer your purely scientific curiosity.
That's beautiful. I come from the passionate personal story, but I think the big brains in the field just come at this because it's a really hard problem to solve. And I think there's a lot of people who want to solve humanity's biggest challenge, which is the fact that we all get sick and old as we age.
And I think if we step out of longevity per se and just ask, what are you doing every day to make a difference, right? It doesn't matter what the motivation is, as long as you're motivated to do something. And so if you're motivated to do this field, do it. And no matter what that motivation is, it's just important that you've got your foot on the gas and trying to move your field or your interests forward.
Absolutely. That's I'll selfishly plug our field. You should get involved with aging. All right. Even if you're not passionate about it, because this is truly humanity's greatest challenge, in my opinion, right? Absolutely. This affects everyone. We know the negative aspects of getting older from a personal standpoint, from a societal standpoint. And I think the more people that we can get working on the biology of aging, producing therapeutics and interventions, the faster we'll get there and the faster this problem will be solved.
It's still so early.
Still so early.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a lot of time for everybody listening to this to get more involved. And you know what I always like to say? You don't need to be a King's College PhD to necessarily make a difference in this field. I come from, I was a physics major and a political guy in college, and here I am on the forefront of the political advocacy effort for longevity. So you don't need to be necessarily a scientist to get involved and move this field forward, but we do need more scientists.
Yeah, it's the same argument. What do we need for the field? You need bright people who are motivated to do their thing, whatever their thing is, moving it forward. And whatever your age is or your experience, just do the best you can.
Yeah, when I started this, I was 22 or 23. And I look back now and I'm like, wow, I can't believe I had the cojones to start this industry association. And here I am a couple of years later. So yeah, there's no age minimum or maximum, right? You can be at whatever age, whatever stage in life and make a difference. So I agree with your sentiments there. So I want to talk to you a little bit about Arrive Bio. So before I ask my question about it, can you tell our audience a little bit about Arrive Bio, which you co-founded?
Yeah, so Arrive Bio is a longevity biotech company. It was co-founded during the sort of time of COVID. And it started, we were all working from home, and a couple of colleagues reached out and said, hey, what are your thoughts about starting a longevity company? And my thought was, we know enough to kick the tires and see if there's something we can do. And it was also in that time of COVID, everyone's thinking about their own mortality. And I was like, and I'd been in academia a while, and I was getting a little bit bored with it. Nothing wrong with this. People argue that it's tough to publish, it's tough to get grants. But also, we were well-funded, we had good papers, and we were doing important work. I just got bored. And so we put this idea of Arrive Bio. So it was started in 2012, and really it was to build a platform, which was called a proprietary platform called Coherence. And this was a knowledge-based platform that would integrate machine learning, bioinformatics, and pathology from a preclinical concept. And so the idea being that we want to go to improve our efficacy of in vivo preclinical models. And so can we improve the target space rather than doing the sort of 10 molecules a year with X number of mice or the very expensive human trials? Can we improve that throughput? And through that, we built out the models. We had some good new targets that we found. We injected the tool compounds. We got some good hits. The problem, and then the doors have arrived closed 3 years later. And did I say 2012? I meant 2022. And so, yeah, Arrive closed. It was really a lot of great learnings. And I loved working in a biotech company. And I think there's a lot of learnings there. Happy to dive into versus what is academia. But also starting a biotech company is tough. And I think we had first-time founder's disease, where everyone has these brilliant ideas, a little bit naive. And so we closed the doors 3 years later after not raising enough money. But interestingly, this was during COVID, and we had an opportunity to build out the labs in Singapore. And the reason for that is because we were building out a large ML team, we got a large grant from the Singapore government that said, if you build it in Singapore, we will pay for it. So being first-time founders, we're like, we like other people's money, let's do it. But it was interesting because everyone's in COVID. And so Singapore was open for business for a part-time, everyone's working, but our main team founders were in California. So that was an interesting tidbit. But again, we built the platform, but it's still in that sort of idea that probably other people experience who've built these times. Well, now you've got the platform, what's your target? Okay, could you have got the target without building the platform? Okay, and what's your next target? And so there's always that moving scoring system from VCs, we felt, which I think is common to many of the startup founders.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's also 2022 and even till now, it's been a tough funding environment for a lot of biotech companies. And I think what you said resonated with me. The first endeavor rarely goes well, and first time founder's disease is real. And the good part is you can always make another biotech, right? And you can always learn from your previous successes and mistakes. And I find that very interesting that you just said that. You talked a little bit about you thought it was boring in academia for a little bit. What are some of the specific challenges you faced, though? I think you were probably pretty happy to get out of academia from what you're saying, but I'm sure that it came with challenges. Obviously, the business side is something new for researchers. Were there any other challenges, maybe for academics listening to this right now, thinking about starting their own venture?
Yeah. I've been fortunate to be in great institutes, Harvard Stem Cell Institute, UCSF, great departments, great institutes. And we were pretty successful getting funding from the NIH and NIA over the years and other so I can't you can always complain you want more money, but I didn't suffer from we're out of money. You can always argue you don't have enough, so you can never do really what you want to do. So I can't say that. I think the part of the problem for academics, and this is at the individual, we are also there to educate and provide training environments for PhDs or undergrads, depending on your campus. And so one of the difficult challenges with a PI who wants to change the world with their discoveries versus nurturing people to train them. There's an internal conflict sometimes, which is, I think we should do these experiments and go that direction of research. There's the PhD student, you're like, we've got to nurture them and let them troubleshoot and learn these things. And so there's an incongruence there, a conflict, which I always struggled with. But I think also the system's changed. If you want to do basic science, it's hard to get that funding versus more what we call, in quotations, translational research. I don't know if it's translational, if you're just putting a drug, small molecule in a mouse, but it's a lot more descriptive for sure, to be sure. I think the career opportunities for people in academia as PhDs or postdocs now have a two-edged, a positive and a negative. So the hierarchy of the tree for people to go to become a professor is now very extreme. Basically, there's too many postdocs and PhDs if we want that to be a valid career path. The percentages are just skewed. However, in contrast, there are also now a lot of biotech companies, especially in certain city demographic areas, where you think of the main city hubs for biotech, San Francisco, Boston, etc., and others. So I see a good thing where now your PhDs and your postdocs are having shorter duration periods and going into biotech. We're still in that sort of crux of, oh, you left academia, quit, or whatever. Like, that is such a self-fulfilling sort of critique from those that are still in academia. Right? So I think there's great opportunities there. There's also now, we talk about the fledgling longevity industry, right? There are now people just starting companies. And so that's a wonderful new thing. And often when I was on that transition before leaving academia, I'd give seminars and do round tables with students, and they'd be like, isn't it risky to start your own business? I'm like, are you getting paid? Are you getting a salary? Are you, if you're getting a salary, the day it stops, there's no risk. It might not work, but it's not risky. Risky is you're not getting paid a salary and you're expecting it to work based on stock that you may get in a few years. And so in 3 years, the company doesn't work. You find another company, you start another one. So I think to loop back, yes, the funding thing with academia is a tough thing. The other administrative burdens, constantly reviewing grants for others and those type of things. But it's also a place to explore. My transition from learning about animal biology, muscles, stem cells, AI, ML, great collaborations with other teams, real exploration for the sake of learning. That is priceless. And I don't think I'd be as successful and have the successes even in Arrive or today without that time to explore.
Absolutely. That is the function of academic institutions for sure. And I will say, I would like to see more academics be quote unquote risk takers. I think there's no risk. There's no reward without risk or something like that. I don't know what the saying is, but if we want to actually get these therapeutics and these interventions into people, right, they need to go through sort of the biotech process. And if you have an interest in actually getting these into the hands of people, you got to go the biotech route almost certainly.
Yeah. The incentive structures, right, are skewed so that you can get a scientific result. And as long as it's statistically meaningful, you can publish on that. If you got a result which was barely statistically meaningful in a biotech company, you'd say, is this better than the drug best in class? No, you shut down the program quickly. And you don't even, just the perversion of saying you can pursue mediocre results or non-game-changing results and get published in your next grant. That just doesn't happen in a company.
But I think that leads to the breakthroughs that we're looking for more. Yeah.
So pursue risky science, but only pursue those things which have an outsized phenotype or an outsized result. Not focus on, oh, here's my safe target and path to publication.
Absolutely. I want to shift to what you're doing now. Obviously, you're at ARPA-H. My first question is, can you walk us through the process of how you decided on becoming a program manager at ARPA-H? And then maybe, you know, what your day-to-day looks like now that you're with a government agency?
So let's look at the day in the life of a program manager. There's multiple roles I'm fulfilling. So what we're trying to do every year is build a new program. So PROSPER is the first program out, but then we also build out projects that people will submit, get reviewed, and if successful, we provide funding and management in quotations of that. Okay, so on any given day, what am I doing? If I'm building a program, I'm looking at the landscape. So I'm asking, where are the opportunities in the tech or the science? Where are the problems with the regulation? Is the regulation good? And who are the VCs in the space? And asking them why they're not investing yet? Or what do we need to solve for so they will invest? So that's landscaping for a program that we'd build. We'd speak to academics and leaders in the field to ask the question, we're thinking about this, what do you think about? Because when we build a program, even though I'm that figurehead, if you like, it's obviously gone through an internal team plus a whole bunch of experts in the field so that we're not going down wrong paths. And then what else? So then you get the opportunity, because we're in a government agency, to meet with other intergovernment agencies, where that's the FDA and other agencies, to say, if we do this, does this make sense? We don't want, because when we build a program, we want it to succeed, right? There's many ways the science won't work, but we don't want to make a sort of programmatic structural error. So that's the program. Then if we're building project, which again is part of that, or that project's even started. For example, with PATH, which is a funding, a PATH project to the Buck Institute, we have internal meetings with those teams every few weeks, and they are to say, is the science moving on track? Is it not? Do we have some exciting results? Do we have things that are not working? Okay, how do we get ahead of that? Because many of these projects are walking in fresh snow. So we don't expect everything to work, but we want to course correct if we can as soon as we can.
That's the whole point of RPH, right? To take these kind of walks in the snow and forge your own path and then do this sort of novel scientific experiments and projects to radically transform how people live and the health of citizens in America, right? So can you tell us a little bit about Prosper and what you're specifically doing on a day-to-day? Do you see this as complementing the broader RPH mission? Walk us through what Prosper is all about.
Okay. So when I joined ARPA, I originally pitched a sort of classic biotech play, but I realized there was a lot more potential there because we're an intergovernmental agency to do things that are not just science-based. And so for me, this fundamental question or the mission of Prosper and why we built it is to, I use this now of the train tracks, right? It's to build the train tracks for a productive therapeutic industry that can target health span. We're actually the end point is to prevent age-associated functional decline. That's what we're going to try and treat, right? And as one of your listeners will know, right, everybody who talks about longevity and builds a company targets an age-related disease. That's not admirable and not important, but it is because of the financial incentives and regulatory structures that is there. And then the hope is someday we somehow repurpose it for general use. I think that derived logic is slow and cumbersome and actually doesn't, there's not good evidence for that actually. It's very inefficient. All companies would love to repurpose. Actually, it's about 20% of companies or 20% of all approved medications that do actually get that. So it's a very expensive and low probability play. So I thought, what if we can build the data to actually build the industry? We need the data, right? It is, the FDA is not going to announce aging an indication. You have to build the data and make the case. So that's Prosper, because currently we don't have an FDA-approved therapeutic, despite everyone's health worsens with age. And so if I could, let me just say, what are the five critical elements of Prosper? It's centered around two things. One is surrogate biomarkers for aging, and then the developing therapeutics that can actually treat. So what do I mean by a surrogate biomarker? So most people in the audience know this, that to run a clinical trial for aging, if aging was your endpoint, could take about 30 years. What we need is a predictor, a biomarker, a surrogate that could tell us in a shorter duration that the phenotype you're seeing or the marker change will predict an outcome 20 or 30 years in the future. So we don't have that in the field. There's been a lot of basic science done around building out biomarkers, but nothing's been validated. In part because it's expensive to do it. It's not that no one wants this. Everyone knows what needs to be done. It's just, how do you do it? So we wanted to allow these excellent teams to come together to propose their biomarkers under a framework. And that's part of a program with ARPA, which is, it's not here's some money and go and play. But there's a real tech focus. It's working with us to achieve a goal. And so our bet that a surrogate biomarker around intrinsic capacity could serve as that surrogate because it has a feel and function and a quality of life to those measurements that will help people. And you will know if you're suffering, your intrinsic capacity goes down, you'll feel it. And if it improves, you'll be functionally better, inferior. So you have to build that. And then the question is, two parts of that. Can we have a kit that people can use at home? And then the second part of it is, can you show it's intervenable with things that we know improve health? So using a sort of gold standard and then saying, is it intervenable? So exercise, diet, health, driving interventions that will then move those surrogate biomarkers. So now we have a case where a surrogate biomarker changes with age, one way or another, and a subset of them will change with exercise or diet. Okay, so now we're getting close to a picture of an intervenable biomarker. The second thing we want to do is now move in towards therapeutics. So we think that there's probably some drugs out there which have therapeutic benefits for diseases, but are safe and could improve health span, the health of a person in the absence of disease. And so we wanted, and many of those clinical trials have been done and the samples are sitting on the shelves tested from diseased people, diabetes, obesity, et cetera. So simply getting those samples off the shelf and asking, which of the surrogate biomarkers that change with age and exercise also change directionally in the same way when you treat the diseased person? So we're now building a case for the FDA to say, look, we've got a surrogate biomarker test on thousands of people. It improves, it goes one way with aging, it goes the opposite way with exercise, and it also goes the opposite way with drugs in a sick population. Okay, so all that's good. I think we could get an FDA surrogate on that. But now we want to go one step further and ask, we actually want to treat people and improve their health in the absence of disease. So that is where we then go to a therapeutics clinical trial. So people have talked about doing these clinical trials for years, 3 years duration, 5 years duration. It's costly. But our designer, Prosper, says this needs to be done. It's the only way to do it. And then we can show, A, we might get a label for a drug that does improve health span over that large trial. But it also now says that surrogate biomarker can be validated because the drug improves health and changes the biomarker. And then the final, so that would be using what drugs that were probably sitting on the shelf and most people know about now. The final part of Prosper is to say, okay, let's say we've built those train tracks. It's formally possible those safe FDA repurposed drugs are not efficacious enough. They might move the surrogate, but they might not help health span to the magnitude that we really want, right? And we're not here for incremental gains. We're here to make a big dent and improve the health of everybody in as most dramatic way as we can. So the final is to let's build those new biotech companies to test out their new therapeutics. And these will be therapeutics that were built purposely for health span. And so what I think the level of detail which I like about this program is the safe trial with the safe drugs have done a 3-year trial. With the new generation drugs, it is a short-term trial that will not do the many years of changes, but asks specifically, does the surrogate biomarker change to now a substantial degree compared to the safer repurposed drugs? So there's three levels of success there, right? And so we build programs around avoiding program failure, right? And so you can program failure would be, we just make new generation medicines and none of them work. You've learned program failure. But with Prosper, we've got three levels, which I think we can get to some degree. One is the validated intervenable through health and exercise and interventions. Two is the safe drug, which proves out the validated biomarker, but might not be efficacious. But we think it probably will be. And then there's the new higher risk, dramatic 20 years health span extension that I think we can get with the newer drugs. So will we get all three? In 5 years, we don't know. But I do feel confident we're going to get the first two.
Beautiful. So when you are looking at projects, how do you decide what gets the initial green light? Is there like a rubric or a metrics that you look at? What's the thought process behind greenlighting specific projects under Prosper?
So we always ask the question, does the project get us to our goal? So there's a bit of a conflict sometimes. Teams want to do what they want to do or what they're experts at. The question is, do what they propose get us to the goal? And that's the sort of the single, they've got to address the goal in what they build. Like any biotech company, we're going to ask about the team. Can the team walk the walk? And oftentimes there's two things, right? A team doesn't form the right team around them. And so they might be expertise in something, but there's something missing that doesn't allow them to achieve the goal. And so teaming is really important to get a green light. So teaming,
Do you help build the teams? Like when you see a gap on a specific team, do you say, hey, here's person X that can help with this? Or is it more like they need to come together with the right team in place?
Yeah, part of the process of before selections, we will allow teaming on websites, ARPA websites, so people can do that. So that's one way to encourage. People have read the demands or the goals, and then they can team. Then we'll review proposals. So right now, as of today, right? So as for the people listening in, the deadline closed for the applications. So all the preliminary short abstracts have come in. They've been reviewed. All the teams have been notified, encourage or discourage. And so when we write a review for those abstracts, we would inform people to say, this was really good, but there's a gap here, right? And we like you for this, but you've got this hole. Now, that's a tough call, right? Because the point is they should have found the right team. So you're like, how many you ask the question, is what they have so worthwhile you give them an extra shot? Or do you favor a team that's put everyone together?
Gotcha. What are the other, are there other things that go into your decision-making on green lighting projects, or is that really it?
Well, I think I'm a data guy. And so when you're putting, I need to understand the science and to say, my best guess is this does move the needle. And it gets back to the impact of the preliminary data or what the mechanism of action is to say, yes, we're going to see something dramatic here. Now, of course, you can never predict that, but it's scientific sort of feasibility and scientific impact. And then sometimes we'll ask the question, well, this academic team, for example, has this great small molecule. Okay, is this small academic team going to be able to commercialize this, get the IP, make a company so it lives in the wild after Prosper? Right? Because ARPA's legacy is not going to be what we achieve with Prosper in 5 years. It's going to be what longevity industry exists in 7 or 8 years or 9 years because of Prosper. Great small molecule, but if it doesn't get to the end, so that's another thing we'd factor in.
Awesome. That was actually, that's a good lead up to my next question. Program managers have 5 years. You're about a year into it. How do you hope the next 4 years unfold? What do you want to say at the end of 5 years that Prosper accomplished? What's the goal? How do you want to feel at the end of 5 years?
Yes. So it's been getting Prosper out was, I think, a major accomplishment, and the design of it and the work that's gone into it. That's been amazing. My team's been amazing putting that together. And now we're at the stage where we're seeing the proposals. So we're now just full gas getting that out. And we'll be selecting the right teams, finalizing the teams, getting the contracts going. What is success like in for Prosper? I think at 5 years, by design, we'll have had meetings with the FDA about surrogate biomarkers and first-generation therapeutics. We're going to have the data to say, does a repurposing drug move health span? And by how much? I don't know if that means we'll have a label approved, right? There's going to be the data first. So in 5 years, I think we'll know we have a drug that moves health span. And it'll have been tested in thousands of people. Or they will, not even just one drug. There might be multiples. So I'll feel pretty good about that. That's year five. So I'll still be at ARPA if I do my 2+3 years.
Yeah. You get excited, by the way. But yes, keep going.
I do think I've got the best job in the world. And so I think there's potential for, there's huge potential for impact here. I think the other side of it, that's a Prosper thing. But as a program manager and my trajectory, I'm going to be releasing a program every year. So Prosper's program one, right? So program two, three, four, all building around these sort of same issues of health span, aging, longevity, aligning it with prevention of chronic diseases. There's lots of opportunities to do some important work. So I'll also probably be really tired and worn out at the end of it.
That's the irony with doing the work that we're doing. I said this to someone the other day. I think I age myself a little more than the average person doing work that is supposed to slow my aging down. I'm with you. Beyond Prosper, do you see ARPA-H being the catalyst for other longevity projects and programs? Where do you see ARPA-H fitting in with the overall longevity landscape?
So I think the mission of the administration and is towards prevention of chronic diseases, and Prosper and aging fits around that. But there's all the two other examples. So there was a launch for a sprint for women's health, which I didn't participate in directly. It started just before I arrived. But there's an exciting part of that as we think about the longevity, which is there's projects funding ovarian aging, a hugely important and underserved topic. And so I think, and one of the things I was thinking about were there and part of Prosper that helped form this as a direct part of Prosper is that performers have to build a sex-specific surrogate biomarker.
Interesting.
And it's embarrassing that this has not been done. And because currently in the field, what people who build these clocks and do is to get all this data from males and females, put it all together, and then ask to validate on a male or female. The data has been built and trained on mixed, on male and female. And so we're saying, why aren't you training and building the data sets for a sex-specific clock? Like, it's saying estrogen does not account for aging in any way. So I think Women's Health Sprint has that ovarian aging component. We're tying a little bit of Prosper to that. And then we did start another project, which was PATH, funded by the Buck Institute. So let me show you a little bit. So the interest on PATH was trying to, and that was, I think it was a project for about 52, up to about 52 million. And it was really to build out longitudinal data in relatively healthy people, but on that sort of, and using diabetes and pre-diabetes as a disease trajectory. And asking through a sort of multi-omic phenome data set, how do we follow people's trajectories? And then how do we see it with high resolution? Because, you know, blood pressure and things like that change in a very dynamic range. But what happens to all these other molecular signatures over time? And what does it mean to have a range that is normal versus abnormal? And so that's what they're going to plot. But why I think it was exciting for me to get involved around PATH and why I excited when I saw the project, it's not just about getting the data. They're going to build other kit to allow this to for people to use, these N-of-1 analyzers, they call them, which is going to be allow us to see our variation day to day and then and how that correlates with sort of movement and other wearable devices. And a separate part, because they're going to diabetes, is to have this analyzer which predicts pancreas function from a wearable. So it allows you to then say, from my wearable, am I getting a pancreatic function? Is my pancreas functioning better or worse? Which obviously is the ultimate decider of whether you get diabetes. So for us, it wasn't just about building the data. It was actually getting a device or a kit or a tool to people in the population that can help their health trajectory. Really? So I think there's lots of interest in longevity and in health span and Prosper associated projects within the agency.
That's music to my ears, Andrew. That's great. Yeah. I have two more questions for you. So the first question is for researchers, entrepreneurs, scientists listening that want to engage with RPH, what advice would you give on how to design proposals that resonate and how can they best collaborate with the agency to turn their ideas into funded projects?
No, this is a really good point. I sit around like a VC, right? Listening to pitches all the time, getting some of these great ideas. But the reality is we're a pretty small organization, 32 program managers. And so we're siphoning all of this information. So it's very difficult for me to say I can meet with everybody. So what I normally ask is, if you're interested in something, just send me a few pages of something you want to pitch to LinkedIn. And that's a way to reach me.
The LinkedIn, you said.
Yeah. And the reason for that is everyone can pitch and tell me what their great thing is, but unless I can see it straight away, it can be a waste of everyone's time, and everyone's time is precious. So I like to say, okay, a couple of pages of what you've done, why is it unique, etc. That can start a conversation. Okay, so what does someone write something and they've got these great ideas? Why isn't every idea great? And I think it starts with, can you genuinely say, if this works, it changes the world? And secondly, it's clunky in what we're proposing. And what I mean by that is, it's not basic, so the NIH doesn't fund it, and it's not well-trodden path, so VCs don't fund it, right? So if someone says we've got a new generation of oncology drug, a VC should fund that. And so is it clunky? Is it something that could have a problem with tech scaling or commercialization? There's no regulatory path, or it's a brand new indication, or it's a new mechanism of action. They're the things that we think, if ARPA puts this high-risk funding towards it, we unlock. Now, in terms of unlocking, what does that mean? So again, I think about this as a biotech going from Series A to a Series B. It's do the thing that gets you the next unlock. And soon as it's done, VCs should come in. That's the way to scope out a project. It's not, here's a preclinical model, let's go to phase three clinical trials. So they're the criteria. In terms of writing something, you've got to tell us the team has feasibility, a track record. Tell us the problem that you're solving and why it's not been solved before. Vague ideas are hard to score.
This is all a gold mine of information for all of you listening that want to work with RPH. So I hope you're all taking notes. Beautiful. Andrew, the last question, and this is the question I like to leave all of my guests with. Now, there's a lot of craziness in the world right now. But I think longevity, aging, health span, whatever you want to call this industry, I think the people in this field feel a sense of optimism when they get out of bed in the morning and they have something that they're pushing towards. So my question to you is, what gets you out of bed in the morning? What, you know, gives you hope, existential hope for the future?
I also wake up optimistic, and this is a unique time. And again, I'm not a spring chicken. And so I've been in this space quite a few years now. And again, when I started, there was not a single company in the space. So I think we are in a unique inflection point. And I get out of bed with both a dread and an excitement that Prosper needs to work. And so I think that whether we get the most effective drug, the mission of Prosper and the vision of ARPA is this is not going to be a therapy for billionaires. This is a therapy for everybody. And so we are on the cusp of being able to, in 5 years, to, I think if successful, provide a medicine that will prevent health decline during aging. That is, and have a biomarker at home or a clinical trial that can actually show us it's working. You know, there are a lot of people in the space and there are a lot of good scientists, but we also have a problem with some of the wellness space where how do we do clinical trials? What is the data? And so I think Prosper also will provide high quality data that people can bank on and say, okay, we know this works. We know this is less effective.
Absolutely. I look at Prosper as like a silver bullet for the field, right? If we can solve not only for identifying these novel therapeutics, but also interfacing with FDA and setting up the infrastructure for the rest of the field, that's what A4LI pushes for. That's what this whole field has been pushing for years.
That's right. I think A4LI and ARPA and Prosper program has that sort of similar mindset. I talked about the program's successes, and scientifically, we might have a really effective therapeutic, but unless it gets integrated into healthcare, it's meaningless.
100%. Yeah. And it needs to be able, it needs to be accessible to everyone. And I think that's something I want to highlight that you just said. There are misconceptions about this field. And if you talk to any scientist, yourself included, everybody's goal is to get this into the hands of as many people as possible, right?
Yeah. Prosper is a catalyst for the industry. Yes, there are people doing great work in the space and the ship is moving in the direction. But Prosper catalyzes to do the right trials that people don't want to fund so that we have the regulatory, enough data to get regulation. But will Prosper build the most effective therapeutic ever? That'll be second generation medicine. That should come on the back of what we learn through Prosper. Absolutely. And so what does second generation therapeutics look like? I think that's a different beast completely. First generation will probably be a small molecule. It's something a bit more tried and tested. When we think about second generation, or if we think about reversal, and what I mean by that is Prosper is all about preventing. There's two realities. People don't take things that are good for them, do things that are good for them. So they'll miss Prosper. And all of a sudden they'll get to an age and they're like, uh-oh. Or there's people who are already too old for Prosper now. So there's a whole the part of this which could be, how do we reverse out of that aged, phenotypically declined functional state back to a functional optimized state? And secondly, in the modality of second generations, is that a mitochondrial transplant, therapeutic plasma exchange? These are things which could be efficacious, but there's differences for safety, commercialization, manufacturing. So second generations might not be about molecular targeting, but actually bringing a drug and a safe drug to a cost-effective and safe way. So lots to be done for all those people listening out there. Lots of opportunities.
Lots of Prosper is setting the stage for all of this to be possible. Andrew, I want to thank you for not only your time today, but for the work that you're doing. I don't know if my endorsement means anything or not. I couldn't support what you're doing more. This is the silver bullet that I think the field has been waiting for, developing the infrastructure around the longevity field that's sorely needed. So I appreciate you. I appreciate Prosper. I appreciate ARPA-H for giving you this opportunity. This is the whole point of ARPA-H, right? To be funding these highly impactful projects. Thank you to you and to the ARPA-H leadership and to everybody involved, because I see this as a real way to make change for not only the longevity field, but for people's health. So I appreciate it. The last thing I'll ask, Andrew, is there any way or anywhere that our audience can follow along with Prosper and your work? Do you post things on social media often? Is there like a newsletter? How can people follow along?
Yeah, yes. Thanks for the very kind words, Dylan. And I think we both sing from the same hymn sheet, right? What A4LI is doing has been so impactful and will continue to be, and is only growing stronger as well. In terms of reach out, yes, there's the ARPA website, the ARPANET. which people can reach out and hear what's going on. There'll be new programs released. Also, we have social media presence, ARPA, or some of the program managers and LinkedIn and ARPA. And then we are now being more visible in the, we are now able to travel more and get back onto We attend conferences now to learn and both for outreach as well. So hopefully people can catch me at the nearest longevity conferences.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Andrew. And we'll see all of you in a couple of weeks for our next episode. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks very much, Dylan. Great to see you. Have a great day.
You too.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Andrew, for making the time to join us today. And for those of you listening at home, I hope you found this conversation as enlightening and informative as I did. If you have anyone you would like to see make an appearance on our podcast, please send your suggestions to us at info@a4li.org. HSPAN will return in a couple of weeks, but until then, let's live long and prosper.